KaiserNetwork.org.
Good afternoon. Please welcome our panelists. Majora Carter, Executive Director, Sustainable South Bronx. Andrew Nacio, Professor of Diplomacy, Georgetown University. And Dr. Enzio Okono-Iweala, former Finance Minister of Nigeria. Our moderator is James Wolfenson, Chairman Wolfenson and Company, LLC.
Well, good afternoon, everybody. After an extremely interesting morning where we have addressed some of the issues that relate to the question of poverty and to the alleviation of that condition, dealing with suggestions from entrepreneurs and from those who are addressing this issue from the private sector point of view, and with Ernesto Zedillo making some very pointed and important comments on scale and on the impact, we come this afternoon to two sessions, the first of which is about partnerships for achieving results, and which I think builds on this morning's discussions. We have three remarkable people to contribute, each for 8 to 9 minutes. And we're going to start with Dr. Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala, with whom I had the pleasure of working for more than a year or two at the World Bank. She taught me everything I know about development. The second we have is Majora Carter from the Sustainable South Bronx, who, as I think many of you may know, has developed an extraordinarily innovative approach that she will describe to us. And my friend and colleague, Andrew Natsios, recently appointed as the President's Special Envoy for the Sudan, a nice easy task for him to do after his career in USAID. And Mr. Natsios will address us not only on his experience, but give us some ideas that he has in terms of partnerships between the public and the private sector. I'm going to call on Ngozi first, who, as you know, had two very significant positions in the Nigerian government, and she will address whatever she wants to address, but in particular, I hope, the issue of how scaling up can happen in a country of the size of Nigeria from where she hails and where she had this remarkable experience. Ngozi.
Thank you, Jim. And I hasten to say you taught me most of what I know. I really want to address this issue of scaling up. And how do you do that so that you can have appreciable impact on poverty in a large country such as mine with 150 million people, or on the entire African continent with large numbers of people in poverty? And I think what brings me to that is what the earlier discussions we had. There's so much energy in this conference, so much energy in this room, people doing perfectly wonderful things. But one of the things that came up in the earlier session is, you know, we've got civil society organizations doing things at village level, at state level, at regional level. How do you get this to have a broader impact? Because if we're all doing all these good things, then why do we have such a serious problem still with poverty? It means we are not bringing them up to the size and scale that is needed to appreciably attack that problem. And so that brings me to talk about 4 or 5 points that I want to make quickly on the issue of financing. How do you finance these things to scale? And I think the first place we have to look is within the countries themselves. If you want to scale up actions that impact people's lives, we have to start within the country, because that's how you're going to get these activities sustainable. We talked earlier about building institutions, but how about financing these actions? And I think that there's still great scope within our countries in Africa and elsewhere for increased internal savings that can be mobilized and put to work for the cause of poverty alleviation. There are other sources of financing on debt relief and debt cancellation, which I'll come to. But first, on the issue of savings, I think that on average, African countries have a savings to GDP ratio that is much less than the rest of the developed world. I think it's about 20% compared to 30% on average. and compared to almost 38 to 40 in the East Asian countries. So the issue is, how do we get greater savings within our own context, within the country, the countries that we're working in, and how do we use those savings better to help leverage these activities we are talking about? In Nigeria, we have had a long history of corruption and mismanagement of resources, which in the last 3 or 4 years of the President Obasanjo's government, we put in place a reform program that focused on managing the resources properly, better than we've done before, saving those resources. We had high oil prices, and we swung from a position in which we had a fiscal deficit of 3.5% of GDP to a surplus of 10%. And I tell people it's not because oil prices were high only. We had high oil prices in the past, and none of that was saved. But it was because of a focus on using our own internally generated resources as best as we could to attack the issues of poverty. And that brings me to one concrete point. We've got activities or pilots on education, on health, on agriculture, and so on. But there are some huge investments that are needed to also bring these activities to scale on infrastructure. And that is something that the government, along with the private sector, will have to do. And that is where this size of savings becomes very important. So I just want us to think about that for 1 second, that to make things work, we've got to leverage internally the savings of the country. The other thing is looking outside, debt relief. We have a very interesting story in Nigeria. I won't take too long over it. But we were successful with the help of Jim Wolfensohn at the World Bank, with the help of other partners around the world, the developed countries to whom we owed money. We managed to get released from paying what would have been $3 billion a year in servicing of debt by getting a debt cancellation worth $18 billion, exiting from our Paris Club, getting rid of our $30 billion debt, and we released those resources and we plowed them directly back into specific poverty alleviation programs in health, education, infrastructure, agriculture that are today being tracked. That is enabling us to go from small-scale interventions to larger-scale interventions. And the problem we have is to monitor the impact on the ground and make sure that the money is actually used. Third thing to look at. Public-private partnerships. I won't say too much because I hear Andrew is going to talk about that. But again, using instruments, innovative instruments like guarantees. Earlier on, we had the Acumen Fund say that they put up a $5 million guarantee to enable an organization, I think in Pakistan, to lend $50 million for mortgages. We need to use instruments like that. Governments have to go in partnership with the private sector to issue these guarantees so that the private sector can feel comfortable taking risks and being able to serve poor people and scale it up much more. And then the last area we need to look at, remittances. There's a large pool of resources from people in the diaspora that is going back to the developing countries. In Africa, we get $7.7 billion last year, 2005, in remittances, of which half is for Nigeria alone. And we have not really thought through, how do you get these resources to work more for you, for the country, in terms of tackling poverty-related projects and scaling them up? So these are some areas where substantial chunks of resources are available, and we need to put our minds to using them in an instrumental way. And we don't have to reinvent the wheel, because some countries have been able to do that. We just need to be able to transfer those experiences and make them work better for us.
Thank you very much, Ngozi. Really a lecture that most finance ministers in developing countries should hear. We now come to Majora Carter, who doesn't represent a country, but who represents an area close to us which has many of the problems that are seen in poverty areas in developing countries. I've quoted her before where she said, economic degradation begets environmental degradation, which begets social degradation. And indeed, she's spoken of the triple bottom line in projects to create economic, social, and environmental value. And I think that's a wonderful rubric around which she can speak, and I'd like you to tell us about your experience, Majora.
Thank you. Because when I was first invited to attend CGI, at first I was like, maybe this was a mistake. I mean, I don't represent any work in developing countries. I mean, I'm from a couple miles away from here. And then it occurred to me that I represent a very poor community, even though it's in the United States of America. You know, we have lots of poverty here. And then it caused me to think about all the similarities that we actually have with the poor all over around the world. And that is that there's often a tacit understanding or perception that the poor are in the position that they're in because it's their fault. You know, whether we like hearing that or not, that's often the way that it is absolutely perceived. And then the other thing was that the poor are often not looked to, you know, as sources of information and expertise that actually could impact the problems in which they're dealing with right now. And it kind of hit me again that, you know, I think before I can even talk to you about what I do, I've got to tell you a little bit about my community. When I grew up, I was born and raised in the South Bronx, and when I grew up, my neighborhood was considered the epitome of social urban blight. It was a war zone. I did lose my brother. He was shot and killed a couple blocks away from my house as a result of a drug war. Banking industries left en masse. You know, you couldn't do any kind of investment, you know, in my neighborhoods at all, which also meant the jobs left. You know, so there we were with this very difficult situation, you know, where people were being besieged upon, you know, by the public perception that this was like an awful, disgusting, ugly place. Landlords were torching their buildings to get insurance money. It was not the most beautiful place to live in. And I, like many people that had an opportunity to leave because of education or whatever else, just took it and ran. And it wasn't until, you know, I had to move back home to my neighborhood just a few years ago and realized that all of the waste facilities that had come to my community after all the manufacturing jobs had left were there because of the regulations that had not been changed. So you had all these waste facilities, power plants, 60,000 diesel truck trips running through my neighborhood, impacting the public health, you know, creating one of the country's highest asthma rates, making people feel as though they couldn't walk around their own neighborhood for fear of being hit by a truck. And it kind of hit me that communities don't just become what they are just because the people who live in them, you know, just don't care. You know, and I was one of these people, so, I mean, it hurts me to even admit that, but that's where I was. And it made me think, like, oh, my God, if this is what's been going on, it's been going on all this time, and I could only imagine what happens in the rest of the world. And so what it did inspire me to do is I got politicized, frankly, and what it did inspire me to do was, like, think about how, you know, what can we do? You know, we know our community better than pretty much anybody else does. You know, and I started to read a lot and got other people to sort of help me do that as well about, like, what actually makes a great community? What makes a community livable? What makes people actually take pride in where they are? What makes people, you know, want to be with each other and actually want to take care of it? And I realized it's like, it is about the built environment. You know, it is about what you see. If you walk out of your house and you see, like, what I saw, which was an abandoned building and junkies walking down your street, you know, every other day, you know, you kind of don't want to be there. You know, if you don't have a place to, like, play, you know, go to a park or feel like you can, like, hang out with your friends just because you can, or if you don't have a decent place in your neighborhood to shop, you know, why would you want to be there? I mean, you will see, you know, the greener pastures, you know, on the other side, you know, of town or whatever, and you'll just start to think, you know, any place is better than this. And I thought, you know what, nobody in my community needs to move out of their neighborhood in order to live in a better one. And so we started looking about what are our assets here. You know, I looked around at the rest of the city and realized that our administration was creating things like waterfront parks. You know, there's a lot of waterfront in New York City. It's like, oh, great, you know what? Guess what? The South Bronx is surrounded on three sides by water. Our waterfront is mostly covered by, like, industry. Well, apparently not all of it. And I bet I can honestly say that I'm probably the only person in this entire room, or probably the conference, that can say that she owes her career to a dog. around the same time we were battling huge waste facilities because they more kept wanting to come into our neighborhood, I got this dog, you know, an abandoned puppy I found tied to a post in the rain. And she took me jogging one day, and she took me into what I thought was just this nasty abandoned, or excuse me, wasn't abandoned, an illegal dump in my neighborhood, one of the many that we had at the time. And, you know, lo and behold, there's all this, like, garbage everywhere and, like, you know, hypodermic needles and just tires, used tires every place. And but at the end of this dump, it was the river. I'd never seen it before. In all my, at that point, 30 years of living in my community, had never seen that before. And was just like, oh my God, you know, this could be the beginning, you know, of the new community-led revitalization of the new South Bronx. And lo and behold, it was. Why? Because I was able to help transform that little park, leverage the money, we got a $10,000 seed grant, leveraged it about 300 times over into a $3 million, park development project, which is the first waterfront park we've had in our neighborhood in more than 60 years. That, in turn, led... That, in turn, led to one of the a really incredible, effective partnership with the City of New York and bringing in various other partners around from the public, excuse me, I'm the public sector, from the private sector, you know, to actually, like, realize that, you know what, if you start cleaning up people's communities, if you start understanding that, you know, it affects all of our bottom lines, if we actually have better communities for people to live in, you know, I mean, I'm so inspired by the work of Enrique Peñalosa in Bogota, who, you know, realized that, like, you know, you have to create cities around people, not around cars. You know, you got to meet their creature comforts. You know, if you do that, amazing things happen. You know, crime can decrease if you transform public spaces to make sure that people can come out and feel like they can play and be around each other. You know, you create more opportunities for community pride. And I was like, I want that for my neighborhood. Like, I need us to be an example for what you can do with a relatively small amount of money, mind you, and leveraging that into better, bigger and better things. We're currently also working now on a project called a recycling industrial park, which simply means that it's a collection of businesses and the waste of one company can become the raw material of another, or you simply use recycled materials in order to, as raw materials, which is, you know, kind of cool and very helpful, I think, in terms of alleviating some of the solid waste issues that we're dealing with right now. And it also can help to create anywhere from 300 to 500 jobs. And we just thought this was the coolest thing ever. And then we come and find out that the only place where you can actually do this, because you're thinking of scale, you have to do it in a place where that you've got barge and rail access, so you minimize the amount of, you know, diesel truck traffic that you use to transport stuff. And we actually even got one of the stranger bedfellows we've ever had, in addition to the City of New York. The company that just won the city's 20-year recycling contract, you know, Sims Hugo New, and, you know, to basically realize, like, wait a second, if we can, like, help create this recycling thing, guess what? It affects our bottom line. It makes us look like a really good neighbor. You know, it makes the community a lot healthier. They're happier we're here, blah, 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 and we all get really happy. And then, lo and behold, the city decides that the best place to build a 2,000-bed jail would be the same place that we want to build this recycling center. Yeah, that's what I said, too. And, you know, and so here we are trying desperately, you know, to do the social justice work, to create opportunities for people, because I truly believe at the bottom of my heart that the best alternative to incarceration, the best alternative to poverty, is a good job. And that we were able to create some partnerships that actually could help make that happen. And we're being kind of, because people are thinking in the old way, because there is this top-down approach that, like, you know, we have to build these communities, you need a certain amount of jails, you need a certain amount of this, you need a certain amount of that, and you're leaving aside, like, the things that actually do empower communities. Having a job that you could actually, like, appreciate and, like, feed your family with. You know, having a community that is not a cesspool of pollution. and having a place that you can call your own and be proud of. I mean, these are the things that these, at a minimum, everybody should have, no matter what part of the world you're from. And my last thing that I want to say to you all, you know, is that I was so freaked out when Archbishop Tutu said that beautiful thing about, you know, that a knife is, I think he said it was a tool, you know, and you could even, you use it to cut bread, it's a good thing. You use it to stick, you know, shove somebody's guts out, it's a bad thing. Power is also a tool. If you use it to exploit people, it's a really bad thing. If you use it to empower and to uplift people and to use it in that way, it is the most wonderful, amazing thing in the world. And the people assembled here today, these past couple days actually, we can change the world, and I absolutely expect each and every one of you to help me do that.
Thank you very much. Well, we've heard a message from the South Bronx that we could use in many other countries. And for those of you that don't live in the South Bronx, I hope you learn something from it, as I'm sure you will. The issue of empowerment, the issue of relying on people and to use the strengths of people in a community is something that certainly I've seen around the world and of which we've just heard a fantastic example. We now come to Andrew Natsios, who spent many years, as you know, with USAID after a distinguished career in public service. And Andrew, I know, is concerned not just about some of the partnerships that he created between public sector and private sector, but the continuity of his efforts and how they're lost. And maybe you can tell us a little bit about the work that you've done on that and how you see this thing, your work, being encompassed by society in general.
Well, the day after I arrived in AID, before I had been announced officially by the president as the candidate to be head of AID, I was back as a contractor, essentially waiting confirmation. The career staff came in and said, we've got a new idea for you. It's called Public-Private Partnerships. Unfortunately, they had already named it the Global Development Alliance, which is the worst possible marketing name I could possibly imagine. But they already named it, so I didn't interfere with the naming process. And they explained it to me. And I endorsed it. And they said, can we go ahead with this? I said, well, technically, I'm not supposed to make any decisions until I've at least been confirmed by the Congress. But since you're not going to tell anyone, it's approved, go ahead and do it immediately. And I won't tell anyone until after I leave office that I violated 16 federal laws by approving this before I was in office, which I can say now because they can't impeach me since I don't have the job anymore. Because it was such an attractive idea. Politically, it was attractive. It was attractive as a new idea, a new approach to things. What it essentially was to change the business model for the agency, at least part of the business model, to use AID's resources to leverage private sector money, and instead of AID being the principal funder, becoming a funder of programs, and using its reach, global reach. Most of AID staff, three-quarters of its staff, are in the field. Most AID staff, in fact, are not Americans. They're third-world nationals. And our FSNs are, many go on to eminent careers in the private sector or in government. The Vice President of El Salvador, first woman, was a Foreign Service National with the AID mission for 10 years. I'm very proud of that. They help run these things in the field. But we had the same business model, and we needed to change it, and this seemed very attractive. Jim Wolfenson used to speak at events, and he'd always fit this little statistic in. The first time I heard it, I said, that can't be true. And then the staff said, yeah, it is true, Andrew, and we're all missing the boat. He understands it, but the rest of the community doesn't yet, which is that in 1970, for the U.S., I don't know what the statistics were for the whole community, 70% of the capital flows from the United States to the third world were public sector money or ODA, official development assistance, and 30% was what we call private foreign aid. By 1998, the statistic had reversed itself. 85% of the capital flows were from private foreign aid, and only 15% was from ODA, not because of cuts in ODA, but because of a massive increase in private flows. And Jim would say that, and he said, you know, we're becoming kind of irrelevant, and if we're not understanding where this private foreign aid is going, then we're missing something. So This idea captured that notion of marrying this public and private sector shift in resources. Colin Powell made this, in a very unusual way, his testimony, half of his testimony for his first congressional hearings on, as Secretary of State in early 2001, on our appropriation bill, state AID appropriation bill. It was a little odd to have the Secretary of State endorse this. He endorsed it. It took me 5 minutes to see it and endorse it. It took him 3 minutes because Colin Powell, most people don't realize, it has an MBA, and he was on corporate boards. He knew the power of this instantly. And if I had not had him and his testimony as a bludgeon, I'm not sure this would have succeeded. So part of this succeeded because of very senior-level support, and the president thought this was great early on, too. But there was a lot of resistance. There was resistance in OMB. There was resistance, enormous resistance in the Congress, because with private sector money, you can't earmark it. And that's why our officers endorsed it very early on, because it meant we could make a deal with a business or an NGO with private sector money, and no one else could regulate it except the deal that they made. And you know, we have to comply with the IG rules and all that, but this was, of course, a godsend for us because we're earmarked to death. It allowed us to work with non-traditional partners, people we did not traditionally do work with, NGOs that had never gotten money from AID, businesses that weren't asking for money from AID, were willing to work with us to give money to a project, which is not typically what the businesses we worked with were doing. They normally were contractors of ours, and this is not the relationship that a GDA would be. We now have 400 partnerships worth $6 billion, not million, billion dollars. AID has put $1.4 billion into the partnerships, and the private sector, NGOs, faith-based groups, foundations, universities, primarily, though, corporations, have put $4.6 billion. And that is a conservative estimate. I told the staff, I don't want any exaggerations. I don't want you to repackage old programs and rename them, because AID staff, you know, the administration's changed, so they just change the name of programs to preserve them. And that's fine. I understand the game everyone plays. But I said, I don't want to do that. So we had very rigorous standards for what you could count and how you could count it. And we would not count a GDA unless AID was less than 50% of the funder. In fact, we preferred two or three times private leverage over public leverage. And what we did is we created, to make it easier for career officers to do this, a new procurement instrument, not a grant, not a contract, not a cooperative agreement. It's a new mechanism. It took us a long time to develop it and get legal authority to do it, because it doesn't exist in the federal system. There's only one or two agencies that have this, that allows us, without competing, to negotiate an agreement with a private sector entity to do one of these GDAs. And that made it much easier in terms of time to get this done, and it reduced the vulnerability of our officers to IG investigations. You know, if you do it the old traditional way in the business model, everybody was vulnerable because, you know, why are you giving a grant to an NGO that's also being funded by a corporation and a foundation? What is this? It's not the traditional model. What are you doing? You're putting us all at risk. So we had to protect the officers from potential problems with the system by creating a new business model in the procurement system itself. We also found the opposition reduced or diminished in the Congress when we started announcing, which wasn't an accident, powerful congressmen and senators were going to announcements of GDAs from their home states or districts. I won't mention which states. I don't want to embarrass anybody. But one of the most strong opponents of this, we announced a big company in his district was funding this. And all of a sudden, the next day, he said, I'll give you more money for this program, Andrew. You won't have any more opposition. Because the business liked it so much. And so this has moved on. We now have a Kennedy School of Government case study on this, and there's a book of case studies you can get on the AID website. The important thing was to get the career staff, though, to endorse this. We did training programs. We did the new procurement model. But the thing was that this began to spread, and this is how the most interesting thing happened. A lot of the initial part of this, the career officer said, look, Andrew's our leader now. We're going to do what he wants. But, you know, when he leaves, we'll dump this stuff. This is not, you know. Until Bob Hellyer, the mission director in Angola, signed a GDA with Chevron Texaco. We put in $5 million. They put in $5 million. And he announced it to the other African AID mission directors and said, I have $5 million in unearmarked money, unearmarked money. No one controls it in the Congress. No one controls it because it's private money in OMB or anyone else. You make the deal as long as we, you know, the money is well spent. And there's no ethical problems with it. You can do your own deals in Angola, and we don't approve them in Washington. They're all approved in the field, and they just do them. And that, all the rest of the mission directors said, wait a second, we didn't understand this was going to happen. How did you get money we didn't get? They said, you're not out recruiting. Go to the business community and the foundations and private NGOs and see if you can't do something. And they started doing it, and that's why, since I left, they've signed another $1.2 billion worth of partnerships, and I'm not around anymore to press them to do that. So it's in the system. It's part of the institution now, and most important, this is the last point I'd like to make. If you do a GDA as a charity, a charitable thing, it doesn't work very well. The business community says, you know, we're just doing this temporarily for a charitable thing that we want to do in the country for public relations purposes. On the other hand, if the GDA is part of the actual business of the company that we're working with, or the NGO or the foundation, where they have technical expertise, and they see it in their business interest to do it, sort of the public use of private interest, then it becomes sustainable over the longer term. And it becomes very creative, because we're not just putting money in. They're putting their expertise, their reputation in this, and it's a genuine partnership, not us giving someone money, because this is a very different way of doing it. And it's really spreading now, and a lot of other institutions are doing this. We're being asked to help. I know the bank did a lot of this before anyone else did, but it is beginning to work. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Andrew, and thank our three speakers for an admirable introduction. I'm told that it's now over to you, and I'm told that someone is going to tell you what to do.
Excuse me, sir. This is not a panel. I would like to presume to tell what to do, so I'm going to tell you all what to do. And thank you all very much. This is exactly what we wanted. It was people to talk about how, to use Majora's phrase, if you can get kind of strange bedfellows, if you can get partnerships of people who don't normally work together to combine and join forces, you can make things happen that wouldn't otherwise happen. And if you listen to Dr. Ngozi, who accomplished an extraordinary feat, in Nigeria, on the debt front. That was through sheer force of will. That was not because the international community was ready to be flexible. If you listen to Majora, that was passion and chance. If you listen to Andrew, it was an initiative, important but an initiative. So the question for all of you, we know these partnerships can work. Here are three extraordinary examples. How do we make them more systematic? How do we make them more deliberate? We have a great platform here with CGI. People come together, they make friends, they may agree to do something together, then we all dissipate. What is it that we need to make these partnerships prolific and sustainable so that we don't have to count on a woman going jogging with a little puppy to realize the potential that people like Majora have, but so that we've got systems and avenues for making that happen as a matter of course? So as before, you've got approximately 30 minutes to come up with the answer. And again, the more hard-edged and concrete can be, the better. And then we will reconvene our panelists for a few questions coming up from you, as well as a reaction to what your own findings are. Thank you very, very much, and thank you to the panelists.
We've obviously had some interesting sessions at the table, and I'm afraid now is the moment to finish the discussions, although there is a young woman in front of me here who is a wonderful person. We've got a number of questions that have been suggested to me to suggest to my colleagues, and the first, which has Ngozi's name on it, and which appears to have emerged from some of your discussions, is how is Nigeria sharing wealth and empowerment in local partnership with your citizens? Drawing on what you were saying, I think people would be interested to know what in fact is happening on the ground in Nigeria.
Thank you, Jim. Well, Nigeria is a very complex country, if I may say so. 150 million people, 374 different languages, not dialects, languages. 36 states, 774 local governments, and one national government. And a constitution that gives the states and the local governments a great deal of autonomy. So when you talk about what is happening on the ground, how are we sharing, how are we making an impact? I gave you that background so you for you to know that to make an impact, you've got to get a partnership between the federal government, the states, the local, and the communities. And it's not always easy. And I'll be frank with you, in many of our states, sometimes it doesn't even work. But in various other states and parts of the country, we're able to come together to work with the communities in making a difference on the ground. Looking at, let's take for example, the issue of the debt relief funds. That is, the money we would have used to service our debt is now being plowed back into specific activities on the ground. And when we initially started, it wasn't easy to really get the impact felt because we didn't have a mechanism to track how the money was going. We had to devise something so that if we agree with the state government and the community that a health center is going to be built, it actually gets built. So what we're doing now is we have a tracking mechanism. We get the state government to agree that if the federal government builds a center, they will put in a road so that women can get to the center. That's part of the partnership. Or if we put in the road, they'll put in water and put in the medicines and employ the nurses. The community will undertake to help maintain the center. So this is the kind of arrangement that we're beginning to do to make things felt. But it's at the early stages. It's working in some places. It's not working evenly. But at least we are charting a course that must involve the community. Because when you're doing something and the community is left out and doesn't have a voice in what you're trying to do, that's when you don't get sustainability. That's when you build health centers that nobody goes to.
I think that's a very good lead-in for me to ask a question to Andy Netsios. But I want to tell you that I'm being polite to Ngozi, despite the fact that in 1960, I was arrested as a spy in Nigeria, because I was taking pictures with a Minox camera, and I discovered that I didn't speak these 360 languages, which was the test that was given to me. Ngozi's all right, I want you to know that. But I want to ask Andrew a question, picking up from what Ngozi was saying. How do you feel about Ngozi's response about the engagement of people locally? It's something that you spoke about, and I've been asked the question here, to what extent were you successful in bringing in both NGOs and local corporate partners to work with you within the local context?
I haven't gone through all 400 partnerships and separated out them in that way, but the charge was to the staff. We prefer local businesses. We prefer community organizations because it builds capacity in the developing world, which is what development's all about. It's not building capacity in a huge international NGO that already has capacity. It's transferring it to local institutions. In fact, I mean, there is a statistic in A that 80% of AID's budget was being spent in the U.S., and someone was bragging to Congress about it. I said, don't ever repeat that statistic. That is a horrible statistic. I said, "This is if this is true, it's just outrageous." So I don't know whether it was true even then, frankly. It was a fight that happened in the 90s, and we were trying to get support from Congress so AID wouldn't be abolished. But we started now a new set of techniques to spend more of the money through local institutions, and I actually signed just before I left. This is the first time I've ever said it publicly. I'm separated enough that I can do it now from time. I signed them so my successor would have to deal with it, to suspend the Buy America Only provisions and require that when contracts are bid on, that any American-based contractor must have a local in the country or a neighboring country bid with them. And there's a whole series of new regulations going in on this. Well, our officers thought it was great. They said, you know what's going to happen when Congress finds out about this? I said, I have the legal authority to do it. I'm doing it, and I'm going to leave.
And if any of you want to learn about this, you can go to Georgetown University.
That's right.
Andrew will never be allowed out.
There is one last thing we tried, which some of you read about in the Wall Street Journal, which is the local purchase of food aid. We've had food aid, Food for Peace, it goes back before AID to the early 50s under President Eisenhower. And I'm into famine relief and famine theory, and Amartya Sen's one of my heroes. And we've always bought the food in the United States, and I've seen people die because it takes 4 months to ship the food from the United States into an emergency. And I said, this is completely unacceptable. When we could buy the food locally, there are always surpluses somewhere in an emergency. So we proposed, the president agreed to it, 25% of the budget of Food for Peace, which is $1.2 billion a year, could be for purchasing food in the country or in the region. And my heavens, as though I had, announced I was a spy for another country or something. There was a huge blow-up in the Congress and the interest groups. I don't want to go through it all. We failed, but then the president put it back in the budget. And the day I left office, the interest groups ran to try to get it out of the budget for the second year, and I convinced the White House to leave it in, which they did. And now there's a serious movement to change the statute next year permanently to allow a portion of that law, a portion of the Title II law, to be local purchase of food from third world countries to encourage agricultural development, which is the appropriate thing to do, and to speed up the delivery of humanitarian, and to reduce the cost, because it costs 40% of the cost of food aid is transporting. If the food's right there, you won't have to pay the cost. You can spend more money on buying food, in addition to helping the farmers. So anyway, the fight's not over, but there are things happening. Again, there are systematic changes, and they take a long time to go through. But if they go through, it will make a big difference.
Well, I'm sure if the logic prevails, it will be a big difference. Majority, talking to people earlier, I think everyone was greatly impressed by the analysis from the South Bronx and the familiarity that has with people working in the international field, relying on people locally, providing them with facilities, appealing to the sense of pride, appealing to them as people and regarding them as agents of change. In your travels overseas, I know you've not been able to extend the work of the South Bronx, but do you have any observations that you could share with us on your travels and on the applicability of what you've done?
Wow, yeah. Actually, I am so blessed because I've had the opportunity to actually see other things in action around the world, and it was because I got a chance to expand my worldview by traveling. I went to Germany and saw regeneration or brownfield development and realized, wait a second, there are places in Germany that are much more contaminated than any place in the South Bronx. And if they can do it, we can. I went to Bogota, which actually, on many different levels, appears very much like the South Bronx. It's considered, this awful drug zone, et cetera. And, we share that, and Latino, mostly Latino as well, and saw what they were doing in terms of creating, urban public open spaces, and also dealing with actual transporting people as the main thing that needed to be transported in order to improve their quality of life. I've seen micro enterprise and lending institutions in Southeast Asia that just kind of like really surprised me and just showed just a small amount if given with the right with the intention of supporting the folks that you're giving it to, and also coupled with support to actually help them move them to the next level, what that could actually mean and actually could really truly empower a community. And so I steal my ideas from every place I possibly can.
Well, we're grateful to you and grateful to you for giving us the insights that you have. We have another, I think, 4 seconds to ask Ngozi one question. What are the oil companies doing to help?
The question of the oil companies is a very long one. In 4 seconds, I feel that over the 60 years that they've been in Nigeria, Shell at least has been 60 years, and the others, they've not done nearly enough. Neither has the government. The blame for the environmental pollution that is in the Delta today belongs squarely on both sides. It's only recently that the oil companies have stepped up to the plate. Well, or are stepping up. They are putting more money. I think Shell is putting $55 million. But I always used to say, and I wasn't that popular among them, that they could not get away in a developed country with the kinds of things that they are getting away with in my country. But that fault also lies with us. So we have to take our responsibility as a government, and that's what we're doing now, to repair the social capital broken with the people in the Delta, to try to begin to put things in place to clean up, but to get them to do so much more. I personally believe they are not doing as much as they can. And that's the bottom line.
Well, thanks, Ngozi. And now we're going to hear the result of what you all think, if I understand correctly.
Yes. I will share with you the synthesized results, and then we'll have a chance to hear from our panelists on their reactions to this. And then we're going to ask Jim to summarize. And then, just so everybody knows the script, we'll do a few commitment announcements in our second panel. On the question of partnerships, there were a number of themes that came forward, I think, about what the elements are of really good partnerships and what we can lend to the mix. The first is that the best partnerships focus on the diversity of participants and draw on skills of partners. I think all three of our speakers have made very, very clear that there is really a division of labor on expertise and that this kind of diversity is critical to success. Creating trust between NGOs and corporations to identify opportunities for cooperation. Again, really important. These are not two communities that historically have been the best champions of each other, and I think the more we can build that foundation of trust through really good examples of what works, the more we can identify areas for new partnerships. Strengthen regional economic partnerships and cooperation on management of shared resources. This hasn't come up that much. I want to thank the table for bringing it up, because I think for all parts of the world, the more there are regional interconnections, the greater the foundations for global connections. That we need to build partnerships to provide vocational training and job placement opportunities for youth and leverage the diaspora to form mutually beneficial partnerships. This is the second time in the course of the Poverty Alleviation Working Group we've heard reference to the diaspora. And I think that's really, really quite important given the valuable talent we have here that can be blended with the valuable talent abroad. Pursuing research and development at local universities to enhance human capital and capitalizing on the breadth and influence of religious institutions. Again, the second mention we have had here today of that, and I think it's no accent given the moral imperative that all of us are, I think, responding to. Three specific things. One is a business trust fund, to create a fund from companies and governments that would tackle challenges and explore opportunities. I suspect, Andrew, the example you put forward demonstrates the importance of this. I think this is something that would be quite useful from New York to Nigeria. Second is a development wiki. I know what a wiki is. This would be an internet-based community, basically, that allows users to connect and share best practices. I think this is something we've really got to do. We talk about this often and just don't do it, but it's a vehicle for connecting the people who are here today and will be with us tomorrow. The third, something that's come up before, this MBA Entrepreneur Corps. Now, I want to let you know that there are several people here who have made yourselves known to me who've said, we're already doing that, or we're doing a piece of that, or we have an element of that. And one of the things I would like to propose is that, given that this has come up about 62 times since it was first raised, if you are doing work in this area, if you'd let membership services outside know, tell them it's just for the Poverty Alleviation Working Group, and we will do our best to connect those dots. With that, Jim, I'd like to turn it back to you for some responses from our esteemed panelists and your conclusions.
Well,
thank you all.
Maybe we should start from the other end and ask Majora if you have any observations on these comments from our audience.
I really like the second bullet. I think it was on the first page, create trust between NGOs and corporations to ID opportunities for cooperation. But I think what we're missing here Al Gore actually mentioned it as well, there needs to be government accountability in this as well, because I don't think, because what the failures that we saw, you know, in the South Bronx were, I mean, all businesses did were take advantage, you know, of the regulations that my government decided that they were not, that they just were not going to do in order to protect the people that lived in that community. The responsibility lies first with them, as far as I'm concerned. So we need to add NGOs, corporations, and government to ID opportunities for cooperation. That would be the only thing that I would add.
Thank you very much. And Andrew?
Let me add a couple of just caveats here. I said when this started in AID, the partnership program, I said the last thing we want is an article appearing in the front page of the New York Times that a foundation we're dealing with, in fact, is a tax shelter, that it's not a serious institution, or that the corporation's about to be indicted for 10 different crimes in 4 different countries, or the NGO that we're working with is a shell and not real. I mean, we got to do some due diligence within the business systems of the agency. And so, for example, for corporations, there's a UNDP social responsibility, a corporate social responsibility list. And we go through that. And we also go through the Wall Street, there's Wall Street catalogs that tell you about businesses, you know. And we use those, too. They're not catalogs. They're databases. And so there's the research that's done before you enter into a partnership so you know who you're dealing with. And you ask the institution you're working with, regardless of what the institution is, charitable or corporate or public or private, why are you doing this? What's your motivation? It's not that there's any bad or good motivation, but if your motives and your objectives are so different than the ones AID is pursuing, then we sometimes say, well, this is really not a good idea for this partnership. Because later on, if you discover what the objectives are and you find they're really completely out of sync with what you want to do, then you have a real problem and people get angry and disappointed and all that. And that's so I think transparency is an essential part of this. Essential part for all the parties, including the U.S. government. I mean, AID has its motive. Sometimes a congressman or senator is pounding them to do something, or the State Department is, or someone else. And, you know, people should know that when they enter into the so transparency is a very important part of this.
Thank you very much. And Ngozi, you have observations on these.
Yeah, first of all, I'm very impressed by what we got back from the tables. A lot of good thought going in here. Well, we are certainly not responsible for all these wonderful ideas. So I want to thank you all. And I just wanted to add to the most powerful new partnerships, I think there should be a bullet about communities in this whole thing. We also need to create powerful partnerships between the communities we're impacting and the government and civil society. So that's one contribution. And I just will take half a second to say that I hope the next CGI will bring more people from the communities that are benefiting from these interventions. I really miss them in this whole thing. On the partnership side, I want to say Jim Wolfensohn has been very modest. He created at the World Bank a whole community and knowledge network to share best practices on development. And I don't know if people know about this and they're tapping into this, but it's very powerful. If you don't know, I strongly encourage you to go to the World Bank website, and it will lead you to this community of shared practices on development. But I also thought that on the first bullet, Business Trust Fund, this whole session has been about scaling up. And I would like us to talk about a fund that would tackle challenges and explore opportunities that enable us to scale up the interventions that impact people's lives. Thank you.
I'd like to, coming through these comments is a very strong theme that governments and civil society and corporations should come together. But I'd like to ask my colleagues whether they've run into the sort of problem that I've run into, which is that civil society competes with itself, corporations compete with themselves, and government departments compete with themselves. And so the notion that we have a simple, let's get the three of them together, sounds great, but in fact, it's very elusive. And I wonder if you could take us to another level of sophistication and tell us, with a minute each, whether it's as simple as it sounds, or whether we're at the beginning of a whole new revolution. Ngozi.
You always start with Peter.
No, of course not. I want to agree with you. I mean, there's not enough time to delve into the complexities. You know, sometimes you think of government, but there are many voices within government. But I think you deal with that by trying to build consensus around specific objectives. This is what we try to do at home in Nigeria, and it was very complicated. You know, what are we trying to achieve with the reform program that we have? And then try to rally people around it. And we got around the different voices by having an economic team that was given the mandate to drive the reform. So if we wanted something to happen at a certain level with the backing of the president, we were able to push that. And that helped us tackle some of these complexities you're talking about. But you're right. It's not as simple as it sounds. And I think we have to be mindful of that when we are trying to push a program. Who is government? Who is speaking? Do we really have consensus around the idea of the program we are trying to push?
Majora?
I agree with all that's been said thus far. And this world is just too big to have only one perspective. That's why I think it's important that for everyone to understand you don't need to have the same perspective, but what you do need to do, what all of us need to do, whether we're from the community or from government or from the private sector, is agree to agree on what we agree on and then work toward that goal. And if making the world a better place through some whatever particular arena you want to work in is it, then you just have to do that one thing. And I've been in so many bizarre series of partnerships, you know, with folks that I've literally been, you know, opposing on one end, and then, you know, on another level, we've been working together, you know, toward a particular goal. But then again, it has to be done, you know, with the spirit of honesty and openness. So I walk into a room, I hope people kind of know who I am and who I represent, which is my community, and ultimately that's my bottom line. But there you go.
Andrew, you're being given the last word.
Well, one of my favorite books in public administration is a book by Aaron Wodavsky and Jeffrey Pressman, written many years ago, called Implementation. Nothing to do with foreign aid or international development. It's about a project in Oakland, California to rebuild the port. The question is why the port wasn't rebuilt, even though the money was approved by the EDA in Washington. And they studied this, and they said, we reached this conclusion. In order to get the project approved and built, we had to get local, at the district level in the city, the district, the county, the state government, and four federal agencies to say yes sequentially 263 times. In other words, there are 263 sequential yeses that were necessary. The mathematical probability in that complex system of getting 263 sequential yeses in decision-making is 1 in 3 billion. That's true. I mean, that was a study, the report. I used to quote this in AID, and they said, why are you quoting us this? I said, you don't get the message. The message is, if you have 145 partners in one of your alliances, there is not going to be any approval to anything, and the project will never get done. Excessive complexity in any kind of a structure, public, private, nonprofit, is a kiss of death. Don't include everybody on earth, okay? The first decision we made is don't have all these alliances approved in Washington or we'll never get anything done. The mission directors have the authority to do this stuff with the communities. If a government ministry is involved, that's fine. If it's a local company, don't bring it to Washington. For heaven's sake, there'll be 3,000 more approvals that are needed and nothing will get done. So we don't actually let anyone in Washington know, Jim, that this is all going on, because if we did, there wouldn't be 400 alliances, it'd be 4 alliances.
You may now understand why Andrew and I are both out of jobs. But we're proud, I want you to know that. And we have very good friends in Majora and in Ngozi, and I'd like you to join with me in thanking them for a very, very good presentation.
Thank you all so much, and I hope you will please stay with us, we're going to now do some commitments, and I'll go to our next panel. But speaking for myself, and I suspect for everyone in the room, we are all inspired to do more and do better by all of you. We come to now the last round of commitments that we will announce here in the Poverty Alleviation Working Group, including one that is pretty new and a bit of a surprise, but I think you all will like very much. So it is my honor once again to introduce our commitment presenter, Sandy Berger, former National Security Advisor, head of Stonebridge International, and an advisor to CGI, who was just here and has since disappeared. Here he is. Ladies and gentlemen, Sandy Berger.
Well, it's great to have this last opportunity to highlight some of the extraordinary commitments that you are all making as part of CGI. Let me start with inviting to the stage Sam Daly Harris, CEO of Micro Credit Summit Campaign, Fazil Abed, founder and chairperson of BRAC, and the great Dr. Mohammed Yanis, founder and director of Grameen Bank. This is a project involving the Micro Credit Summit Campaign. The commitment is to enlisting and training the world's 20 largest microfinance institutions to measure progress on the first Millennium Development Goal, halving the proportion of people living under $1 a day by 2015. This commitment is worth $922 million over 6 years. The Microcredit Summit Campaign will train the world's largest microfinance institutions to use cost-effective poverty measurement tools so they can tabulate data on the proportion of people living on less than $1 a day. Until recently, there was no efficient way for microfinance institutions to find out whether their clients earn less than this threshold or had moved beyond it. And that made it hard to track success reaching the first Millennium Development Goal. This will be a challenge to enlist the microfinanced institutions. But with better measurement tools, policymakers around the world will be able to measure progress on poverty reduction and to better assess which interventions are working. It's a great project. Thank you very much. If I could ask you each to sign this, or perhaps Sam to sign it on behalf of all three of you.
Long name.
It's a long name. It takes a long time to sign. Very good. Thank you very, very much. Let's get a picture here. Next, I'd like to invite John Bryant, the founder and CEO of Operation Hope, to come up on stage. The organization involved here is CETA University, the City of Wellington, and Operation Hope. The commitment is to delivering free financial literacy instruction to youth in Johannesburg and Wellington, South Africa, and establishing those cities' first Operation Hope Banking on the Future offices. This commitment is worth $250,000 over 1 year. CETA University and the City of Wellington will fund Operation Hope, a U.S.-based NGO, as it offers financial education to South Africans aged 9 to 18. Operation Hope will offer these services at no cost to school districts, and it will focus its services in urban, underserved communities. A terrific commitment. John, thank you very much. If I could ask you to sign this so that you're committed, and then we can all thank you collectively.
Do you have a pen?
I do have a pen, yes.
Thank you.
You have to give it back to me, though.
I was about to keep it. Yeah.
Your commitment did not include one pen.
Ooh, for $250,000, I can get a pen?
I'll give you a pen. If I have two, I'll give you one. Thank you. John.
I'm trying to get to work. So.
Thank you very much. Next, I'd like to ask Linda Rottenberg to please join me up here on the stage, the CEO of Endeavor. Linda, are you here? Yes, Linda's here. This is the commitment of Endeavor. It's a commitment to partnering with global corporations to attack the root causes of poverty, lack of jobs, opportunity, and social mobility by supporting entrepreneurs in the developing world. The value of this commitment is $15 million over 3 years, and they are still soliciting funding. As our great leader would say, this is a big deal. Endeavor commits to finding 10 world-class business partners that will each make a donation of $1.5 million over 3 years. This funding will be used to jumpstart private sector enterprise in the 8 countries where Endeavor already operates and in other emerging markets in Asia, Africa, and the Middle East. Together, Endeavor and its corporate partners will train the next generation of entrepreneurial leaders through mentor programs, workshops, and fellowships. Thank you very much, Linda. It's a wonderful project. Let me ask you to sign this, and then let's all express our gratitude to you. Do you have, you can use my pen.
Your pen's better.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Linda. Now, if I could invite to stage the incomparable Gene Sperling, Jamie Cooper Hone, Deborah Berger, not my daughter, who is the Deborah Berger, but the other Deborah Berger, Peter Buffett, and Jennifer Buffett from the Novo Foundation. The organizations involved here are Gene Sperling, and who is in and of himself is an organization, I must say, and the Center for Universal Education at the Council on Foreign Relations, which he runs, Jamie Cooper Hone and the Children's Investment Fund Foundation, Deborah Berger and the Unbound Philanthropy, Peter and Jennifer Buffett from the Novo Foundation, and Angelina Jolie, Goodwill Ambassador to the UNHCR, an honorary chair of the Global Campaign for Education. Unfortunately, Angelina could not join us. The New Education for Children in Refugee and Conflict Situations Initiative will develop and find funding for projects that provide education for tens of thousands of children who are refugees or have otherwise been displaced by war or conflict. The initiative has fostered the first of what it hopes will be many grants to come, a $15 million commitment by Peter and Jennifer Buffett of the Novo Foundation to provide education for 35,000 children in West Africa. This initiative needs more partners committed to education for displaced children. I encourage everyone interested in making such a commitment and joining this extraordinary enterprise to see Gene later. Thank you very much for this. If I could ask you all to sign this and give me back my pen. Thank you so much.
I'm sorry.
Okay. And when next time I see Angelina Jolie, I'll get her to sign this.
Why don't we all stand together and take one group picture here. Thank you very much.
And the MBA Enterprise Corps to make a commitment. If I could invite Michael Levitt, the President and CEO of Citizens Development Corps, to the stage. Citizens Development Corps is making a three-year commitment valued at $23 million, $10 million in cash, and $13 million in guaranteed in-kind match to finance, recruit, and train and deploy 150 recent MBA grads from top 50 business schools and three-plus years of business experience to serve as volunteers for at least 1 year in eight countries within the developing world. Implementing poverty alleviation through the creation of economic growth, employment, economic opportunity, and new family and national wealth will be the focus of their attention. Corps members will work with multinational corporations to implement specific corporate social responsibility projects while serving with business, governments, and NGOs. This commitment, Citizens Development Corps commits to having at least, as part of this, eight Corps members working with South Sudan government and business by January of 2007. Michael, thank you very much. And I should say, those of you who have talked about this idea of MBA Entrepreneur Corps who want to participate with Michael should see Michael after this program. Thank you very much, Michael.
Thanks.
This happened so quickly we didn't have a certificate.
Thank you, Michael.